Welcome to the first episode of Clause 8. We will be talking to a lot of interesting people in the IP community. Today, we're lucky to be joined by former Chief Judge of the Federal Circuit, Judge Rader. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Eli.
I really think you're one of the most fascinating people that I've come across in the IP community. But the question that I wanted to start with is, while you were the Chief Judge, you also made time to be a trial judge at the Eastern District of Texas. You were a law school professor. You traveled around the world speaking at conferences, and you even had your own band. How were you able to do all of those things at the same time?
Well, I had a lot of help. I had good law clerks. I had good staff at the court, and I was fortunate to have good support.
So obviously, there's a lot of IP issues to talk about, but I wanted to talk a little bit about your background. And I heard that before you even went to law school, you were on you did mission work in Finland, and you ended up across the border during the Cold War in the Soviet Union.
Can you tell us that story? That story must have come out of one of my classes. But yes, I was on a day where I could travel, and I ended up traveling across the border, and I was picked up by guards on the other side, and I quickly asked to be returned, and fortunately, they did, yes.
How did that experience, just being in Finland, you grew up in America, but how did that experience being in Finland shape you?
Well, I learned the language, and I became a translator, and I think I gained an appreciation for other cultures and languages, and it helped me as I went on then into my career.
So, and you began your career, so you went to GW Law School.
I did, yes.
You began your career in Capitol Hill. How did that come about? Were you always interested in politics?
It was kind of necessity. I was at GW in law school, and I had my first child and needed to earn some money, so I went to work on Capitol Hill kind of as a survival mechanism.
Do you remember how you found that first job?
Yeah, I do. I kind of went door to door and asked if they were interested in hiring a young law student, and I finally found someone who was.
While we were getting ready, you were telling me another good story about eventually you went to work on the Senate side, and you became a mini celebrity during one of judicial hearings.
Oh, well, yes. I think I was telling you the story of being in front of the strong lights for 8 or 10 hours during a Supreme Court nomination, and so I put on sunglasses, and the news accounts took pictures of me in the sunglasses, and then they would dub in humorous comments as to why I was wearing the sunglasses.
Did your friends and family appreciate that, or you get the big time at that point?
Yeah, at that point, it was any kind of notice is better than none, I guess.
And then you eventually went to work for you became the chief IP counsel at the Judiciary Committee.
I did. I worked on IP and the Constitution. I was the two things that I was I developed some expertise in.
Were you already interested in those areas before you started working in that role, or did that?
Yes, but the job kind of pushed me to develop more what I was interested in. I'd always thought I'd perhaps do trademark work, and so that's why I grabbed that IP portfolio, and it, as you know, kind of changed over time into a patent interest.
While I was researching this, and I mentioned it to you, I found out that John Podesta, actually, who's now the chairman of Hillary Clinton's campaign, he was working for the same subcommittee for the Democratic side.
And I can remember John and I, of course, had responsibilities to work against each other on occasion. But I can remember him calling me and saying, you know, you should come to the floor right now and offer this amendment. Now, I'm going to have to oppose it, But if you put it on this, it's likely to pass. And he was right. And I hope that I was generous in returning the favor on a few occasions.
Did you sense where his career was going? Was he more political, or was he interested in the issues as you were? Or,
you know, there was a brief period of time when we talked about going into business together, you know, and be opening some kind of a lobbying firm. But then I moved into the judiciary, and that ended that.
So I guess that was another question I had was, while you were in the Senate, was lobbying your goal, or did you start thinking, I want to be a judge at that point? Or?
No, the judge was I was working extensively with the Justice Department on some of these Supreme Court nominations, Scalia and Rehnquist and O'Connor. And at one point I was giving briefings to one of the candidates, Judge Bork, and the Attorney General evidently said to his aide that they should find a judgeship for me when it was over, and that's how it happened.
And obviously, Judge Bork's nomination was quite contentious.
Yeah, it was very contentious, you're
and,
right.
Any stories from that? It seemed like you had a good relationship with
lots
John
of stories
Podesta,
from
but...
that. Of course, we worked for and against some of the same issues, but with a great deal of civility and friendship and courtesy. As I say, some of my best friends come from that era. But I can remember telling Judge Bork that he needed to inject more feeling into his presentation, and illustrated it with a couple examples. And he looked at me and he said, "Randy, I'm a judge, not a politician." And of course, he was right. And he also lost.
Were you surprised about how willing he was to answer the questions, obviously, of the traps that were set up for him in terms of his issues on hot button issues? Or?
I don't think I was surprised. That was just his nature. He was going to answer every question, and he was sure that he could explain it in a way that people would understand, but he explained it in kind of cold-blooded legal terminology that didn't translate well into the media that was observing.
Yeah, up to that time, it seems most nominations sailed through, and this was really the first contentious one.
Well, there had been a few contentious ones before, but you're right. This one changed the game completely. It from that time on, it was always a contest of trying to find just the right question phrased in the right way to trap the nominee into saying something wrong.
So as you mentioned, but that process, something positive did come out of it, is you were considered for nomination.
Yeah, well, it was about 6 months later that I got a call from the counsel, the assistant attorney general in charge of doing this kind of finding judges, and he said, and he began to explore with me if I'd be interested in doing some kind of work as a federal judge, and we did eventually find something that fit for me.
Initially you were nominated and appointed to the federal claims court.
That's right.
But
right.
At that point, did you already know that eventually you wanted to join the federal circuit? Or?
No, I don't think so. Although one of the things we discussed was going directly to the federal circuit, but I was very interested in doing trial work and kind of moved things in that direction. The claims court turned out to be the right place.
When you were appointed to the federal circuit,
two years later, actually.
How much did your views on intellectual property issues come up?
It came up a bit. By that time, when I was on the claims court, I expressed a great interest in handling patent cases. Yeah. they were not popular cases with the other judges on that court. So I got a large group of them, and I handled them, and so I kind of developed an interest and a bit of a ability to deal with them, and that's what propelled me into the Federal Circuit.
What about the patent cases that interested you?
I can remember some of them, you know, some on thermonuclear powers, some on connecting two Navy ships at sea for refueling purposes, and lots of technology like that.
So were you always interested in technology? Because you were an English major, from what
I like to brag that I have a technical degree. It's in English. But yes, I did enjoy those technical cases, and the science was of great interest to me.
Is it something you discovered while you were a judge?
I think so. Yeah. I think that became, I found that I enjoyed those cases more than the government contract cases that I got many of as well.
So going back to the during the process when you were appointed to Federal Circuit, I know, were there contentious issues relating to intellectual property at that time, or was it really about trying to figure out what's the best way forward? I don't know.
No, there weren't. Great issues of intellectual property concern at that time. The Federal Circuit was seen as doing exemplary work to kind of revive patent law, which had suffered under many years of contrary and conflicting doctrines amongst the various circuits. And frankly, the Supreme Court had contributed to that by issuing conflicting judgments, and the Federal Circuit brought it together and gave some uniform standards, and it was reviving our innovation economy. So this Federal Circuit was seen as an important part of our economic rebound.
Is that something that excited you, or maybe concerned you about the burden, the commitment that you have to make to the court?
Well, at that time, it was something I was enthusiastic to participate in.
So I guess the second memory that stands out from taking your patent law class at GW is I was actually there when the Bilski decision came out, and I was sitting in your class, and I was actually reading through your opinion, and you noticed that, and you said, you know why the majority opinion is so long? And you were telling me that story, and you said something along the lines of, it's because when you come to the wrong conclusion, it takes a longer to reason there.
I think that's right. If you're following the law, all you have to do is say, here's the law, we fit within it, therefore the judgment is clear. And, of course, this was making an exception take on more weight than the law itself, and it wasn't even an exception in the law, it was a judge-made law. So again, you have to do a lot of explaining as to why you think your exception is more important than the rule, and why you as a judge have to make up an exception when the law has worked so well on its own for 200 years.
And at the time, I remember there was a lot of anticipation for the opinion to come out, but did you have a sense this is going to be the first case in a string of cases where the Supreme Court might step in and use it as an opportunity to restrict what's patent eligible?
That's a good question. We did not anticipate at that time that Mayo, Myriad, and Alice would follow Bilski. Bilski, I remember the Supreme Court said, was the case that had garnered the second most amicus briefs in the history of the Supreme Courts. Well, at the time we thought, they will recognize that this is a specialized area and defer to our expertise and with Bilski behind us, we can move on. Instead, I think they became enamored with all the attention they got, and they returned again and again and again, and I don't think they improved on any one of those.
So I guess obviously it's hard to maybe hindsight's 20/20, but in some ways the Supreme Court agreed with you because they said, well, this machine or transformation test is just being made up by the Federal Circuit. That's not really the ultimate test for whether something is patentable or not. Do you think that the majority opinion was different? If, for example, your opinion was a majority opinion, then we might be in a better place now in terms of how the Supreme Court would have looked at those.
Well, the Supreme Court kind of followed my opinion in Bilski, as you remember, and that has led to a ongoing search for what is abstractness. In retrospect, it might be better if we just stuck with the machine or transformation test. Yeah. But the Supreme Court was looking to devise some new way of articulating their exception that didn't follow the written rule of the law. And they jumped on abstractness as their answer, followed that, and it's led us into a deeper hole.
Yeah, and that's interesting. One line I was rereading your Bilski opinion stuck out to me. You said, because this court, however, links patent eligibility to the age of iron and steel at a time of subatomic particles and terabytes, I must respectfully dissent. And I guess my question is, do you think the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court continued making this mistake?
I do think that the advance of technology has outstripped the court's ability to really understand and deal with it. That becomes very clear in the Myriad case, above all, where you're dealing with biotechnology and they don't see the fundamental difference of an isolated, purified, separated gene that doesn't exist alone in nature, and yet they call it a natural phenomenon, which of course it isn't. You don't have any genes except the kind you put on one leg at a time underneath your jacket, but you don't have them just hanging out of your body. And suddenly we had isolated it and put it to many vastly valuable uses in terms of diagnostics and treatments. And suddenly that is that entire area of research is unprotected, which means you will receive less investment in it. If you don't protect it, the investors will instead invest in cosmetics or something where they get a bigger return.
Yeah. And that, I think it's another line that I heard you say, that the patent system has the potential to let us cure, to find the cures for cancer, but the question is, will it let it? And it seems, talking to you today, it seems you have a lot of concerns with whether it's the Supreme Court is letting the patent system do that.
Well, whenever you depart from the law and presume that your exceptions, your philosophical insights, your, in this case, musings on what is abstract and what isn't, which isn't anything in the law, when you depart from the law, you are no longer acting in legal fashion. You've crossed over into some kind of netherworld of guessing. And that's what you have now, is subjective, unadministratable standard that doesn't provide the kind of certainty you need for business decisions.
So I think even Justice Scalia said that his hardest case that he had to preside over was a patent case, and people guessed that he was probably referring to Bilski. Overall, do you think that the Supreme Court...
Yeah, he told me that, actually.
Do you think they have the ability? He told you that it was
Exactly. Scale. Yeah, he did.
So do you have any thoughts about the Supreme Court's ability to handle patent cases? Is it something that is there a level of difficulty that comes with patent cases that they don't have with other types of cases?
I don't think it's a question of difficulty. I think it's a question of adherence to the law and its predictability and its capability to resolve disputes without creating the kind of subjective, unadministratable rules we have now. The best way to do this is to look at the rest of the world. And frankly, there's no country in the world that does what we do here. We have, once again, set ourselves on a course which is out of harmony with the rest of the world's intellectual property standards. And that, I can tell you that my work in China and Japan and Korea tells me that the companies there are quite delighted to pick up the slack where American companies don't have quite the protections that they do under their law.
At this point, well, I have two questions, I guess. One is, obviously, you knew these justices personally. Were you surprised or disappointed that these conservative justices who talk about these same kind of things, adherence to the law,
I was very
activist justices?
I was very disappointed. The same people that speak so passionately about following the law as it's written instead decided they would write their own law. And it hasn't worked.
And why do you think that happened? Is it they didn't delve into the matter?
Oh, well, that could be a whole nother conversation. I think there was an awful lot of policy concerns about how patent law was causing a lot of litigation, some of it of an abusive nature, and of course some of it not, but the press gave great attention to the abusive litigation, and suddenly the Supreme Court said, well, we're going to see if we can't help here. And I think their effort to introduce some kind of tort reform logic into patent law has had a deleterious impact on our innovation policy.
So do you think it was a blind spot that those conservative justices have? They didn't realize they were making policy-based decisions as judges when it came to patent law, or was it?
Of course, you're asking me to read their minds, and I can't do that. I just can guess as to their motivation for departing from something that they would usually protest as their foremost goal, which is to follow the laws written. And in this case, they do not.
At this point, I think anybody who practices in this area can agree that when it comes to subject matter, eligibility is quite a mess. Do you think that the Supreme Court should step back in and try to fix what they created, or is it better for them to step away and see what develops the Federal Circuit? And
well, sadly, the Federal Circuit has done no better and in some ways worse than the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did give repeated invitations to the Federal Circuit to not apply this too strictly or stringently, recognizing that to do so would be to swallow much of the import and purpose of patent law. And so they, I think, invited the Federal Circuit to find ways to reduce the impact, the negative impact of Mayo, Myriad, and Alice. And yet, if you look at the statistics, 45 out of 50 cases that have gone to the Federal Circuit on 101 grounds have been declared ineligible. And some of them are pretty hard to defend. The one that comes to mind quickest is the Ariosa versus Sequinom case. Now, there have been a few. There are five cases where they have made an effort to find a way out of what I think they're beginning to realize is a regime which is missing the entire point of the patent law. And we'll hope that they continue to improve. But at this point, the Federal Circuit has not been an answer.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but in my sense, you think it's probably better for the Supreme Court to step in and maybe try to guide them again, the Federal Circuit, to...
Well, either that or Congress is going to have to step in and make clear that the patent law is not a place where you do anything other than protect invention and innovation and promote the advance of science and the useful arts, to use the constitutional phrase.
So, and going along with that, I think the former USPTO director Kappos, he actually proposed getting rid of Section 101 altogether and letting the other sections handle whether something is patentable or not. Would you agree with that proposal, and do you think that's something that the Congress should seriously consider?
Well, anything at this point is an improvement over a set of rules which are not working at all. But I think there'd be a better ways to deal with it rather than wiping away statutory language which has been in effect since 1790. And if applied as written, will operate wonderfully, as it did for over 200 years.
Right now, it seems that you were talking about the five cases at the Federal Circuit. It seems a lot is dependent on what judges you actually get for your panel, right? Is that your sense, or?
Well, some academic scholars have made that criticism. The point is that the whole system has failed. It broke down with the three Supreme Court cases, but in the past, the Federal Circuit always made an effort to rescue those mistakes, and in this case, they have not. In fact, it's invited the Federal Circuit to ensure that the Alice decision did not have that impact.
Just to play a devil's advocate for a second, and you were talking about before about the importance of innovation, especially in fields like medicine and possibly cures for cancer. But others say, well, you don't really need patents for software innovation. Even if you don't have patents, people will the threshold, the investments that you need for research and development aren't as great. How would you respond? Do you have any thoughts about those?
Well, yes, as a matter of practical application, software is functional. Therefore, it can't be really the functional aspect of software can't be protected under copyright. It's not a trademark denoting the source of a product. It is a way of making a machine do things that faster, more reliably, with more automaticity and less mistakes, and magnifying human capabilities to the extent that we can do microsurgery, we can do things that are beyond comprehension, and that's all software. That is the future of innovation. It's the heart of innovation. And to say that that's not protectable, first, it's contrary to the language of the Patent Act itself, but it also is contrary to a sound policy that sees a protection of innovation as the way forward for any economic development.
And you touched a little bit on this, but I was recently reading a blog post by an Australian patent attorney who quit his job because he says most of his clients were software companies, and he says, I can't provide, and Australia has followed American law, and he says, I can't provide value anymore to my clients because the law is just so unpredictable, there's no clear boundaries. And at the same time, as you mentioned, in China and in Europe, the situation is doing better. How is this putting America at what effect is it having in America?
Well, I can show you many instances where inventions that are eligible for patenting in foreign countries are not eligible for patenting in the United States. Eventually, that will lead the investment in that form of technology to move to a place where it can be protected, where its worth is acknowledged by the legal system.
That is troubling. I guess we'll come back to it, but so the Congress did get involved a few years ago with the AIA, and when they were discussing the law, it seemed that you were a bit optimistic. You thought it would give make America harmonize with other countries in terms of first to file.
Yeah, I was very enthusiastic about that aspect. And by the way, that has been a positive part of the Act. Harmony in economic laws across borders makes great sense. We have an international marketplace, and an international corporation or business can't be expected to make a different product for every different legal regime. They need to have some kind of reliable harmony across the systems. And so I was very enthusiastic about that aspect of the America Invents Act.
But I'm sensing overall, what is your overall opinion of how the...
Well, there's a lot of the Act that kind of changed directions upon implementation. For instance, if you remember, there was a big battle in the AIA over opening a second window to attack any patent at any time, indiscriminately, multiple times. And in the post-grant review section, they kind of closed that second window. But then, of course, IPR became a second, third, fourth, and fifth window that can be opened at any time. And you see multiple repeated institutions of IPRs against the same patent. You would hope that there would be some kind of system that would cause IPR to perform the function it was meant to perform.
In fact, you and we were talking about it earlier, that you refer to the Patent Trial and Appeal Board that decides these IPRs as the death squad for patent rights. And it seems that remains your opinion.
I think in rough terms, they still accept about 80% of the petitions that are filed, and 80% of those are invalidated. So that's a pretty high percentage.
Yeah. And do you think there's anything that could be done to improve the decisions of the PTAB right now with the AIA as it stands, or does Congress need to go back?
No, I think there's a good deal that could be done to improve things. For instance, multiple filings against the same patent ought to be something the PTAB could deal with by rules. They should be able to dismiss repetitive filings against the same intellectual property.
Something else that was discussed when the AIA was drafted was finally ending the fee diversions from the patent office. And that seemed to be when that amendment was struck from the bill, the major IP organizations came out against AIA and AIA still passed by overwhelming margins. I guess, did that surprise you from your time on Capitol Hill, that the major IP organizations all opposed this major IP bill and still passed, like...
Well, by that time, it had so much momentum that it was going to pass. But the fee diversion is... I think, if I remember correctly, there was an agreement between leaders of the administration and Congress that this would not occur. And I hope that that agreement is adhered to.
Yeah. So you mean without putting it in the actual...
Well, I'd prefer to have it in the actual law. Yeah. I mean, the point of the fees is to make the Patent and Trademark Office into an organization which is driven by user fees. And so the innovation community, which benefits from the protection of its inventiveness, will also fund the effort to protect. Of course, now that's the same institution which is deprotecting through the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, so it's a little bit schizophrenic where you have 6,000 to 8,000 people granting patents at one end and then a group of 300 judges invalidating them at the other.
And I think this ties in something that I was going to discuss next, but I guess a major driving force behind the AIA and some of these new bills and some of the court decisions, like you mentioned, was this hysteria over non-practicing entities and patent trolls. And that's my language. But why do you think the interest groups that represent these Silicon Valley companies and other interests that want to create this hysteria, why do you think they were so successful in creating this idea of a patent troll?
Well, there's a little irony. Many of those companies became leaders in their respective areas of economic dominance by using patents. The PageRank patent, which, by the way, it acquired from Stanford, is much responsible for Google's preeminence in the search engine market. And yet once they've achieved that market dominance, then they perceive that the way to preserve that is by buying little companies that are making inventions and driving the technology forward. And to the extent that they can depress the prices of these inventions and these startups, they can acquire them for less. We'll have to hope that there's realization of the importance of economic development in coming years. I saw a really excellent paper from a Hoover scholar, and it said they had never found an instance of a strong, growing economy that didn't correlate with a strong, protective patent system. And by the same token, they couldn't find an instance of a failing economy which was declining in world market share rather than growing that didn't correlate with a weak and non-functioning intellectual property system. Yeah. And so it's kind of ironic that we here in the United States are trying to do something history has never done: weaken your patent system while growing your economy. Those are counter correlations, according to the scholarship.
And I guess the key is really getting that scholarship in to bring that kind of awareness to Capitol Hill. So you were recently appointed to be the distinguished professor at Tsinghua University in China. And from what I understand, you there's only been how many appointments?
Well, just a handful over the years.
And the rest have been Nobel Prize winners.
Well, quite a few of them. I'm not sure. Yeah. They've also got a few presidents in there of countries.
How did that appointment come about, and how did your interest in Asia develop?
Well, I've been teaching at Asian universities for many years, and I have taken a great interest in trying to improve legal education, and I think some of that effort has translated into the success that you talked about.
Is there anything in particular about Asia that interests you? Is it how quickly it's changing and growing in China?
Well, yes, I think there's a real commitment to intellectual property as a path to economic development there. They're investing a great deal in improving their courts and improving the administration of their IP systems, and it's bringing great results.
I guess I wanted to end with asking you for some advice.
Sure.
I'm sure a lot of people will be interested to hear it. I guess for a law student who's just in your class or at another law school and who wouldn't have the same opportunity, if they wanted some advice about how to figure out their path or maybe possibly become the next Judge Rader, what advice would you have for them?
Well, I think it's important, particularly in this field of intellectual property, that you recognize that in an international marketplace, you no longer can just study U.S. law. You're going to have to know the law of China and Germany, and you're going to have to be able to apply those different legal regimes to protect your client and its interests across international borders.
And what do you think students can do? Is it take classes or educate themselves?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. It's interesting that my class at George Washington University has dozens of students from China and India and Korea, and students as well from Europe and Africa and other parts of Asia. So maybe we need to find ways to gain education elsewhere, as well as paying attention to classes which teach law beyond just the U.S. borders.
I guess the next advice is for clients who or companies that might have a case at the Federal Circuit and they're trying to figure out, well, how important is the written opinion versus the oral argument? Do you have any thoughts about that?
I remember one of the great lawyers that taught me in my youth saying that you can never win a case during oral argument, but you sure can lose one. Now, this was the great Rex Lee, who was the Solicitor General of the United States. So I would, at the time, I remember arguing with him about that. And I've come to realize, of course, he's very true in his analysis. The real key to appellate jurisprudence is your brief, your briefing. That's where you're going to present your case in its best light. That's where most judges are going to reach their decision in reading that material. But you still can make mistakes in oral argument that can cost you even a winning case.
What do you think are some of the qualities that make an effective oral argument?
Oh, one of the great skills is choosing what to argue. You can't argue a multiplicity of points, so you're going to have to choose carefully what you argue and how you argue it. And that's a lot of the skill of the appellate advocate, is knowing what to argue.
Does that also apply for the written brief? Should you also...
It does apply to the written brief, as a matter of fact. If a brief has 20, 30 issues in it, that's almost an admission that you can't point to a single reversible error. A brief that can convincingly show that there is one doctrine or rule which requires a different result or a new trial, you really then only need that one issue. So again, it's the skill of presenting that in a way that the court will understand.
And as we talked about, you also had an opportunity to preside over various patent trials. Do you think the skills, what are the skills you think for makes an effective trial attorney?
A trial, of course, is quite different. In a trial, you are dealing with usually several issues of claim construction on the infringement side, and you're dealing with doctrines of invalidity on the defense side. And so you do have to be able to balance a multitude of issues while preserving some kind of a theme and a reason for the jury or the judge to see the case turn out in the way that you're advocating.
So thank you for your advice, and I guess I want to end with two questions.
Sure.
And one question is, I guess a lot of what we talked about, it seems a little bleak. It's hard to get a patent. Once you get a patent, you don't know if it's going to survive. Do you have any advice about how we can change this, or do you have any, any optimism that I guess you can...
Well, patent lawyers believe in change and believe they can improve anything. That's the same as their inventors. Is we deal in law and in policy surrounding that law that is trying to improve. And so, yes, I have great confidence that with a clear focus on the purpose of patent law, which is to provide a sound innovation policy, to promote economic development, to protect research and development, to spur investment, with an understanding that that's its purpose, we'll return to the roots that are most important to the country's patent law.
So, good to hear. And I guess the last question is, if you could share, what is the best decision that you've made in your career? And
the best decision I've made in my career. I'm not sure I have ever thought of any of them as being best. I've made a great effort to treat every litigant equally and to try and make the decisions reflect a uniform grasp of the purpose of patent law. But which is the best?
No, I was your personal, not a court decision. I know you mentioned that joining the Federal Circuit and...
I see. Well, I have said that in my experience, the best thing that... I've had two magnificently wonderful things happen to me in my life, and one was joining the Federal Circuit, And the other one is leaving the Federal Circuit because it's opened up such vast horizons to me to do work in an international arena, helping with the business as well as the legal aspects of intellectual property. And I'm doing what I want, when I want, with whom I want, and I actually get paid for it. So I couldn't be happier.
Seems like it's about time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. I'm happy. Thank you, Eli.
Thank you.